All right, let's continue our series this morning on California's bid to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. Proposition 19 would treat pot like alcohol by making it legal for adults and subject to regulation. Supporters of this ballot measure say it would effectively kill the black market. But as Michael Montgomery reports, breaking California's underground trade in marijuana might not be so easy.
This past summer, dozens of drug agents in paramilitary gear marched into a remote area of Northern California, west of the town of Redding. As helicopters swirled over the sun-baked hills, the agents used machetes to chop down more than 10,000 bright green marijuana plants. The plants were then lashed into 500-pound bundles and airlifted out. For Lieutenant Steve Solis of the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, this operation was one of dozens of raids on illegal pot farms this year.
Lots of water, the growing temperature's just right, the elevations are just right, and the big thing here they have too is I-5. It's easy transport out.
Marijuana seizures like this one are running at record levels in California, having more than tripled since 2005. But drug agents say they're getting only a fraction of the total crop. What's more, with the pot market here saturated, dealers big and small are moving the drug out of state in ever larger quantities, using everything from overnight delivery services to tractor trailers.
We're seeing more and more of the marijuana cultivated in California being exported where there is a market that will pay more.
Bill Ruzumente is a former DEA special agent who heads a regional agency that monitors drug trafficking in California. He says the pot cultivation boom here began soon after voters legalized medical marijuana 14 years ago. Now, Ruzumente believes California could be a net exporter.
Literally, we have had shipments of marijuana from California seized in all 50 states, and they're going to where they can maximize their profit.
The surging demand for California-grown pot is good news for some growers and bad news for the drug war. But the trend could challenge a key goal of Proposition 19, wiping out the illegal drug trade.
It will generate billions of dollars for local communities, allow police to focus on violent crimes, and put drug cartels out of business.
This television spot for Prop 19, featuring former San Jose Police Chief Joe McNamara, began airing this week. In an interview, McNamara drew parallels to the repeal of alcohol prohibition.
Al Capone and his bootleg gangsters were shooting up the streets, not because they were drunk on booze. It was for the vast underworld profits. And once alcohol was legalized, it put them out of business as bootleggers. And that's the goal of Prop 19 that would be achieved very quickly.
But opponents argue the black market will survive because the measure won't change federal law or statutes in other states. George Mull heads the California Cannabis Association, a medical marijuana group that opposes Prop 19.
There are millions of plants being grown illegally. A lot of it is being sent out of the state. There's no way to think that if Prop 19 passes, those same folks are going to register their grows and then keep all of their plants here in California.
Mull says that's because prices will stay higher in other states where pot remains illegal, leaving in place a premium for smugglers.
There's a great deal of incentive to sell your product where you can get a higher price.
We spoke with more than a dozen growers, from big illegal players to small-scale cultivators, and they agreed that the black market would persist unless marijuana is legalized nationally. One of them is an illegal dealer who agreed to show us a bunker-like growing facility north of San Francisco.
I'm standing in a large garage that's been retrofitted with vents and fans and swirling air filters. In front of me are several rows of squat marijuana plants. Their buds are about the size of golf balls, and the grower here says they're almost ready for harvest.
The man declined to talk for broadcast, but he's grown marijuana illegally for years. He's also acted as a broker to major trafficking groups that ship thousands of pounds of pot out of the state. He said legalization in California would force prices down and probably take many street dealers out of business. But higher prices for exports would keep other illegal growers and dealers afloat. Where there is demand and big profits to be made, there will always be supply, the man said. But other growers say it's not just money that keeps the black market alive.
There is a tradition that we come from here that is of the cowboy mentality, and that is steeped and it is very, very deep.
Gabriel Martin is standing outside a small warehouse in the coastal town of Fort Bragg, where he runs a legal medical marijuana collective. On a recent evening, Martin was busy making a batch of hash, which requires mixing marijuana stems and leaves with crushed ice, then filtering the concoction through a washing machine.
We have pre-soaked the processed cannabis and the ice in the water, and we are bringing up the water level within the washing machine.
Martin says many growers like himself support Prop 19 because they're willing to trade high profits for a greater sense of security and community. But he says that doesn't mean the underground trade will go away.
This is what I tell people. I mean, if you're going to engage in contraband sales or private sales, as we call them, that market is going to consistently exist. It's anywhere you have finance, you're going to have black market, regardless of what industry it is.
Some California law enforcement officials worry that the black market could grow even stronger, with criminal gangs using legalization as a cover for massive smuggling operations. But Joe McNamara says similar arguments were made against the lifting of alcohol prohibition, and they proved wrong. He says marijuana is no different.
Commercial growers would be regulated. They would be controlled. They'd be subject to law enforcement. And if they were illegally exporting the drug, that would be against California law as well.
McNamara says he hopes the push for legalization will spread across the country. He says that would make it easier to enforce state regulations. California voters will decide for themselves next week. For NPR News, I'm Michael Montgomery.
Our story was produced in collaboration with member station KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting's California Watch. Tomorrow, we'll hear what Mexico thinks about Prop 19 as authorities there battle with violent drug cartels.
For now, we can tell you that Mexican President Felipe Calderon strongly opposes the measure legalizing recreational pot. In an interview with the Los Angeles Times, Calderon said it would have, quote, serious consequences for American and Mexican society. Business incubators are supposed to work like incubators for babies. The programs provide physical space and resources for entrepreneurs with the goal of keeping infant companies alive. But the time spent in an incubator does not necessarily translate into economic success. Emma Jacobs reports for the Innovation Trail, a journalism center that covers upstate New York.
By the end of high school, Brent Angeline had 3 years of computer programming experience. In college, he tried out every obscure operating system he could get his hands on. And after graduation, he started building his own.
I figured, why couldn't we take your entire computer operating system, your whole sort of desktop environment, and move it to the web so that you can really bring up the same thing on any screen?
Have us jump back in here.
Now 29, Angeline operates out of a spacious office in the Greater Binghamton Innovation Center. He has no customers yet because his product's still in development. But in about a year, he's expected to be financially ready to leave the incubator and go it alone.
By that time, we'd certainly be able to tell one way or the other, but we're definitely in good shape for that. It's not like it's an impossibility.
But here's the catch, and it's a big one for an incubator like this one that's funded by $500,000 in state and federal economic development money. The first study to try and compare incubated companies to businesses on the outside finds companies like Angeline's housed in incubators aren't actually performing better.
The data show that being in an incubator actually hurts your long-term survival in the economy.
Alejandro Amezcua conducted the research with funding from the Kauffman Foundation. He was surprised to find that drop-off. He's not sure yet whether incubators are propping up businesses that would fail on their own, or if maybe access to expert advice convinces failing entrepreneurs to get out early. But he also found that only 3% ever tried to make it on their own. Amezcua's study looked at 18,000 businesses in 950 incubators. David Monkman heads the National Business Incubation Association. He says the results are counterintuitive.
It's unfortunate. Yeah, I think it's unfortunate to see a number so low as that. And it doesn't
correlate with the numbers that we have.
Since Amezcua is the first to try and make this kind of comparison, there's not much research to compare his numbers to. Monkman points to some very successful examples, but his survey of the industry relies on data self-reported by his members and excludes facilities that aren't providing enough services.
Business incubation programs are more than bricks and mortar. The best performing business incubators relative to the graduates and their performance are those that have received a packaged, integrated bundle of services that help them become more competitive.
The county official who helped found the incubator where programmer Angeline works is Darcy Fauci. It's too early to gauge the incubator's success rate, and she's still working to develop support services for her tenants. She says she's concerned about maybe a third, but still thinks with work, the investment can pay off.
Nobody's ever gone into an incubator business thinking that this is a home run and everyone who goes in is going to be a success. But what we can help them with is an environment where they can spend time focusing on their products, get a market, get orders, get customers, and then they can, the other stuff will naturally come, hopefully.
The Kaufman-funded study found some high performers. University affiliations and female entrepreneurs in incubators seem to do better. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Binghamton, New York.
But there is some growth in long-distance train travel. More people rode Amtrak in the last year than ever before. The most popular Amtrak line continues to be the Northeast Corridor from Boston to Washington. That train can be faster than a car or an airplane if you calculate the trip from door to door. Reporter Nancy Solomon boarded Amtrak to bring us this report.
The Acela Express is the jewel in Amtrak's somewhat tarnished crown. It's sleek, fast, and deluxe, offering Wi-Fi, work tables with electric plugs, and leather reclining seats. It slices through nightmare traffic in a megalopolis that includes Boston, New Haven, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, where one city's suburbs sprawl into another's. Rod Norman, a banker who frequently travels between New York and Washington, used to prefer flying, but he finds it too much hassle.
You got to go there, you have to wait for an hour, and then frequently on Fridays, specifically, travel between D.C. and New York is delayed.
By taking the train, he can spend most of the travel time productively, rather than schlepping to and from a flight. That ability to get work done is contributing to Amtrak's ridership increase, according to Emmett Fremo, head of marketing and customer service for Amtrak.
What's important in the growth of ridership is the increasing the perception of the relevance of train travel.
Fremo says the Northeast Corridor is not only the nation's busiest and most profitable rail line, it's also a model for how other regions could benefit from an investment in the infrastructure needed to create intercity high-speed rail.
All that happens because of state and local urgency and political will and ability to move a national agenda.
Even on the Northeast Corridor, high-speed trains capable of going 165 miles per hour average 80 because the system lacks a dedicated track that doesn't have to be shared with other trains or car crossings. And it's expensive, costing more than $300 for a round trip between New York and Washington. Now new bus companies like Bolt and Megabus are drawing away business with cheap, clean service. They offer Wi-Fi and electric outlets and pick up passengers away from funky bus terminals. Nicholas Klein, a graduate student at Rutgers University, is studying these new bus lines and found younger, more affluent riders are filling the seats and seeing bus travel as hip.
So people are much more willing to take a bus because it's seen as different from the old idea of what an intercity bus was. So it's not like Greyhound, it's a new type of service.
Amtrak says it welcomes the competition because the economy will grow when this congested region has the capacity to move more people more efficiently and with less energy consumption. Even so, Amtrak is countering the popularity of the buses with a plan to offer Wi-Fi on its cheaper trains of the Northeast Corridor, and it just last week introduced new food offerings on the Acela. Emily Wilson, a 25-year-old New Yorker who works in the fashion industry, has tried the new buses. She prefers the train, but has no intention of trying the new menu.
There's absolutely no way I would ever eat train food. That's like plain food. That's just, no, that's creepy. No, no way.
Nevertheless, Wilson was enjoying her trip, with her laptop on the tray table and her phone in hand, surfing the internet and working while on a quick getaway to help her sister pick out a wedding dress. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Some homeowners are considering this question, to pay or not to pay. Not because they can't afford their mortgage, but because they don't want to keep paying on a home that has lost value. This is called strategic default, and it's controversial. Some would say unethical, because it means backing out of a financial obligation. Still, with about a quarter of American homeowners owing more on their mortgages than their homes are worth, some say it's irrational to keep making those payments. NPR's Yuki Noguchi talked with one such couple and has this report.
Grace Chen is no financial novice. She's a CPA working for a venture capital firm. But she and her husband have big financial regrets about buying their house.
We made a bad investment. I mean, I'm from a finance background. It makes no economic sense for us to hold on to this asset.
The asset, their home in Mountain View, California, bought for nearly $1 million, is now worth 20% less just 3 years later. They can't refinance because the value of the home has dropped so much.
I don't know. It's just frustrating because I'm just trying to do the right thing. But I don't know. I think we have to, like, take care of our own business, too, if we're not going to get any help.
The help they're asking for is an interest rate reduction from their lender, Bank of America. For the past year, Chen has spent many lunch hours on the phone trying to get a loan modification. She acknowledges they overspent, but also feels the banks and Wall Street helped create the housing bubble. Until now, it's been her husband, Antonis Orfanou, who's argued for walking away. He says they could rent a similar size house down the street for a third their mortgage payment.
I personally feel like our money just evaporates. It's as if just throwing money away.
But here's the thing. This couple isn't in financial trouble. They haven't lost their jobs. Their interest rate hasn't changed. In fact, they haven't even missed a single mortgage payment. But they're tempted to. Chen says she's usually the type to immediately pay bills online, but when it comes to the mortgage, she procrastinates.
Sometimes if it falls on a weekend, I won't make that payment until the following Monday. I mean, that's how it's gotten to me. It's like, I want to give them the money at the last possible minute. Maybe it's just going to be one day I'm not going to make that click. And it will be like, oh, well, we just missed that payment.
The thing that holds Chen back is her worry that a foreclosure could limit future job opportunities because employers often screen for poor credit. The mere fact that people like Chen and Orfanou are considering a strategic default does not bode well for the housing market, which already stands on a shaky foundation.
Well, it would really mean another tidal wave.
William Wheaton is an economics professor at MIT who studies real estate. He estimates there are about 2.5 million homeowners at risk of strategic default. He says buyers overpaid and lenders enabled and even encouraged the overspending.
There's two parties to blame, and they have to share in the pain.
Wheaton says one way to divvy up the pain and prevent strategic defaults is to pressure banks to refinance homes and allow both homeowners and lenders to share in the upside if the house is later sold at a higher price. This is not a solution the American Bankers Association supports. Robert Davis is executive vice president of the ABA.
We believe that people should meet their contractual obligations when they have the ability to meet them.
Buyer's regret is simply not a good reason to abandon a home or leave a community with a vacant home, he says. Chen, the California CPA, says she's heard that argument before. On the day we spoke, she sounded tired, her voice a little raspy. She'd spent 2 hours in a heated exchange with a friend who'd told her she was wrong to seek any help at all and to even consider walking away.
Because he felt like his taxpayer dollars are going to help people like me, and he didn't like that at all. So I get that. I get what he's saying.
And while she understands, she's not at all sure they're going to keep making those payments. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.